In the public safety and security policy and finance to order. We'll start with the roll call.
Representative Cornish. Chairman Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean.
Here.
Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grassel. Representative Howe.
Present.
Representative Romer.
Here.
Representative Lucero. Representative Neuberger.
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill.
I'm here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Representative Frank, have you had a moment to review the minutes and see if they're correct from the February 15th committee meeting?
Yes, I have, Chair, and I will move the minutes.
Any corrections? All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Approved. Anybody opposed? Minutes are approved. Today we're going to start out with House File 817, dealing with the Point of Sales Terminal. Representative Lunan, if you want to have a chair and start out. And I will move the bill to be referred to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for hearing my bill. This bill deals with ID theft and the problem with skimmers. And what a skimmer is a device that will capture identifying information regarding someone off of their card. And the problem we're trying to solve here is that we have people at an organized crime level accessing ATM machines, but more prevalent accessing gasoline pumps. And of course, it's illegal to steal someone's identity and use it. However, right now we've got a problem with it. It's not illegal to have opened up the front of the gas pump or the ATM machine. And the people that are doing this have a down pat where it's a very, very quick procedure. I was actually at a gas station out by 169 in my district of Shakopee, and I saw a guy do a terrible job of parking, which is why I looked at him. And what he's doing, he's parking at an angle, and he's parking in between the pumps. So what he was doing is he was blocking the view of the cashiers to the outside two pumps. And just had to look over there, and it looked like he was getting down to check his tire, as if it was flat or something. And I realized he was facing the pump. He wasn't facing his vehicle. And as quick as he could take a key and open up the front of it, he reached in and he put something in there and then closed back up, and he was long gone. That was on a Friday. And this bill, what it does is it makes it wrong to access gas pumps and ATMs that aren't yours. And I have a testifier today, Mr. Chairman, that can speak about this a little more in detail than I can.
Go ahead. Please state your name and for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is John McCullough. I'm a volunteer with Financial and Retailers Protection Association for the last 20 years. And we've been working on bills like this to try and make it a deterrent as well as give law enforcement the tools they need to deal with these individuals that are opening up the gas pumps. They're not only opening up gas pumps, they're also cutting holes into ATM machines and accessing ATM machines. They're also putting equipment on ATM machines. They're also sliding devices over your payment terminals. So this bill covers those aspects as well. So this is a real solid bill, something that law enforcement has been looking for, as well as the financial community and retailers.
Thank you. Members have any questions? Is there anybody from the public that wishes to speak on this bill? Okay, then I will renew my motion to refer House File 817 to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
Thank you.
Next we'll have House File 714. Representative Miller, welcome to the committee. You wish to start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe I need someone to motion for this to be re-referred to.
I will make a motion to re-refer to Health and Human Services Finance for House File 714.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. To everyone's delight, I will be brief. I want my testifiers to really tell the story, but just to understand what this is, House File 714 is a bill that is a continuation of work that we've been doing since 2011 here in Minnesota. This is a safe harbor law for children who have been trafficked, and I'm going to be asking for your support, but right now I'd like to hand it over to my primary testifier, Mr. Jeff Bauer of the Family Partnership.
Please state your name for the committee, then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Jeff Bauer, Vice President of Public Affairs at the Family Partnership in Minneapolis. Our organization for over 45 years has had a program serving women and girls escaping trafficking and sexual exploitation. That's why I'm here today. I want to start by thanking Representative Miller once again this year for authoring this bill. He's been a great leader on this. Some of you know he has Heartland Girls Ranch in his district, which is a great place where a lot of these kids end up. So thank you, Representative Miller, for that. I'm going to run through 5 years of history in 90 seconds or less, just to get everyone up to speed on where we were and where we are now. So 2011, Minnesota became the fifth state in the nation to pass a safe harbor law. Basically, what that law says is that if you are under the age of 18 in the state of Minnesota and you are being trafficked or you are being exploited, you are not a criminal, you're a victim of a crime. That probably seems very obvious to everyone sitting around this table, but I'll tell you, a number of years ago, we had to change that because a lot of these youth were ending up in the juvenile justice system. So we did that. In 2012, we spent a year building what's known as Minnesota's Safe Harbor, No Wrong Door system. That is the entire statewide system of supports for children who have been sex trafficked. We came back in 2013 and started talking about how to build that in Minnesota. That plan cost $13.3 million then. It still costs $13.3 million today while I sit here. Over the past now 4 years, we've built that piece by piece every year. And so I'll tell you where we are today. When we started this in 2011, there were only two shelter beds for sex trafficked youth in the entire state of Minnesota. They were right here in St. Paul. They were at Breaking Free. As we sit here today, there's now over 40 shelter beds around the state of Minnesota for children who have been trafficked. As you'll hear, those are only partially funded from our next testifiers. When we started out, there were almost no services for sex trafficked youth around the state of Minnesota. Now there are grant-funded supportive services around the state. And possibly most important to this committee, when we started this process, there were almost no law enforcement trained around the state either to identify child sex trafficking victims or to investigate these cases. Now there's, and I'm looking at Representative Pinto, who had a lot to do with building this whole part of this. Thank you for your leadership. I believe over 2,000 law enforcement professionals around the state of Minnesota who have been trained to identify victims and to investigate cases. This committee last year also took great leadership in approving more resources for law enforcement agencies for the capacity to work on these cases, so thank you all for that. If Chair Cornish was here, I would thank him for that as well. So this year's bill, House File 714, represents the remaining $2.3 million of our $13.3 million originally proposed safe harbor system. What that gets is additional shelter beds around the state, especially in greater Minnesota where there's still gaps, additional services, and some more capacity to do better at this and parts of greater Minnesota where we still need to do work. So with that, that might have been 90 seconds, I'm not sure. But with that, Mr. Chair, members, we have some more testifiers, and I'd like to introduce them, if that's okay with you.
Go ahead.
So Mr. Chair members, I want to bring up Beth Holger Ambrose, who's the executive director of The Link. In Minneapolis, they provide safe harbor shelter and housing as well as services. And most importantly, I want to bring up Simeona Williams and Fawn Lemieux, who are two of the amazing youth leaders at The Link, who actually built The Link's entire system of supports for trafficked youth, for their brief testimony. Thank you.
Thank you so much, members of the committee, for hearing us.
Please state your name for the record, then proceed.
Sure. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Beth Holger Ambrose. I work with a nonprofit organization called The Link. We provide services in three areas to youth and families throughout the seven-county metro area, which include juvenile justice, alternative programs, housing and services for youth and young families experiencing homelessness, and emergency shelter, housing, and supportive services in collaboration with our state safe harbor law, no wrong door response for youth who have experienced sex trafficking. We're here today to show our strong support of full funding for the safe harbor, no wrong door response. Like I said, we're one of the partners in this work, and again, we appreciate Representative Miller and Representative Pinto for all that they have done to support this work. Thank you so much. We provide the West Metro Regional Navigator, which is a first call response for young people who have been sex trafficked within Hennepin, Scott, and Carver counties, as well as passageways and emergency shelter for minor victims of sex trafficking, and a housing program specific to sex trafficking victims 16 to 23, and a variety of supportive services, including an on-site school, mental health therapy, aftercare, and many other things. In 2016, we served in our shelter program alone over 67 youth, and we were full pretty much every day, unless there was a transition happening that day. And we also had a waiting list of 4 to 7 youth on any given day. Our housing program also was full and served a waiting list every day. In terms of the young people that we have that are coming into the services at The Link that are sex trafficked in addition to our shelter, we're serving, you know, between 100 and 140 youth per year, and we're turning away several others. And we know that that's just a scratch on the surface. And so we really would appreciate the support of additional funding so that we, alongside many partners in the state, could expand to be able to serve more youth. It's really tough telling an FBI agent, sorry, we have no room. We're going to have to figure out something else. Or a young person, more importantly, too, that's been found in a sting over in the middle of the night. Sorry, we're going to have to figure out something for you. We'll help work with you, but we don't have any room at passageways. Just to let you know, just a couple of highlights from young people we've served in the past year or currently are serving. We had a young person who was 15 from St. Paul who had been sex trafficked by several different traffickers. She was trafficked between Minnesota, Texas, North Dakota, and a few other states. And actually came to passageways. Unfortunately, she was in handcuffs when she arrived because the law enforcement agents were so worried about her running away. And she actually came into our program and stayed a full 3 months, participated genuinely in mental health therapy, our survivor mentor program, and never once tried to run away. And actually, when she went back to talk to the judge at Ramsey County, said she was thankful for being referred there and is now actually residing in our housing program and is doing really well, is working on finding a job, has healed from not all, but a lot of the trauma she's been through, so just doing really well. We also have, just wanted to highlight, we serve youth in our shelter from all over the state. So recently we also had a young person, 16-year-old girl from Wright County, who was referred, who was being trafficked, and she let her school resource officer know about the trafficking situation and then was connected with us at Passageways. So lived at Passageways. We worked with her mom, child protection, and was able to safely reunify her at the end of her stay with her mother. During this time, she also, because she had found a safe place and received services, was to be able to cooperate fully with her law enforcement that were investigating her trafficker. He was not only involved in trafficking, but was also being accused in a homicide investigation, so she was able to provide vital information as well as our staff supporting her in terms of addresses, IDing him, and things like that that really helped the law enforcement in that situation. So we feel like it's a really, really worthwhile investment for our state, and it's the right thing to do on behalf of these young people who are truly victimized in horrific ways by this crime. So with that, I would like to introduce two amazing young leaders that I have with me from The Link, Simeona and Fawn, to give their testimony.
Go ahead with your testimony, if you could start by giving us your name.
Hi, my name is Fawn Lemieux. One of the most, I think, what she's asking us to do is to state why this bill is important. And I think one of the most important reasons for me is because before when I was younger, I didn't have, you know, a place to go where I would be accepted and stuff like that. And so now that we can give a place to go and where they feel accepted and have therapy and the right services that they need and stuff, it's really helpful. And to see that we're helping a lot of young people get out of what their current situation is. And so that's probably one of the most important reasons it's important for me.
Thank you for your testimony. Again, if you could please state your name on your record.
My name is Simeona Williams. I am a survivor on the Survivors Advisory Committee with the LINC. The reason why I think this bill should be passed and is important is because there's so many things that these kids had that they never had and everything, and I feel like the place that we made, which is Passageways, is everything that we've never had. I mean, this place is playing like the mother that was missing in their lives, the father that was missing in their lives. Everything else is kind of irrelevant when it comes to how these youth are supposed to be living, because it's, how would you feel if your child was out there on the streets and everything? You'd want to do something about it, right? And I feel like you guys, you know, we can do something about this together. I mean, basically, we have to link together. We all have to do something about this because these youth are so important. I feel like they have so much more to be. They can be, like, sitting in the same spot I'm sitting in right now. They just have to believe in themselves. They have to have services in order to get there, to get here. It took me a while to get here. I never thought I'd be sitting here. But, I mean, they can do it. I know they can. They just need help.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Howell?
Well, great testimony, and thank you for being here and stepping to the plate. I guess my question would be possibly for the bill author, but the question I have is, how many shelter beds do you have for the males that have been trafficked? Have they been, do you have anything for the males that are, I know that this isn't a single sex issue, so.
Thank you so much for that question, Representative. I completely agree with you, and actually academic research shows that too, that males and transgender young people are victimized at equal rates to girls. And so that is why at Passageways, our shelter and housing program is open to any gender identity. So we can serve girls, boys, transgender youth in that program. Right now, in terms of shelter beds, we are the only one that's open to boys. There are other shelters for sex trafficked youth through 180 Degrees, Heartland Girls Ranch, and Lifehouse. But to my understanding, those beds are just for girls. However, Lifehouse does have a housing program that's also open to boys. So in terms of shelter beds, we're the only ones that can serve boys, but housing for sex trafficked youth, there's more options than just us. Lifehouse has some beds available too in Duluth.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so those beds that are open to the males, then if they're outstate someplace, do they get transferred then, and those beds are available to them no matter where they are in the state?
Yes. We definitely, in our shelter program, can take youth who have been sex trafficked within the state of Minnesota from any parts of the state. So we do see youth from very rural areas, suburban areas, and inner cities, which I think it's important to note that trafficking happens in all those communities. And so we have had boys. We had a young boy, 16 years old, from in the past year. He was from a suburban area and had been solicited online by a trafficker. And so was unfortunately recruited into trafficking that way, and we were able to work with him and his father and help, again, safely reunify them. But boys are definitely trafficked as well. Thank you for bringing up that point.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the testifiers, too. I've had the chance to present and train, actually, with all three of the representatives from the LINC on several occasions. So and you can see that they'd be really, really powerful in front of law enforcement audiences and others. And so thank you. I want to thank Representative Miller for his leadership on this and a number of the other folks in the room who've been driving at this. And I guess just to make sure members are aware that this really is part of a multi-year vision that a number of people have had. And our state has been nation-leading, and it's kind of been through legislatures, through multiple legislatures, multiple years, but we've continued to be really taking a kind of first-in-the-nation perspective, so I appreciate Representative Miller continuing that. There is a really big gap still between the need and the support for it, but that gap has been closing, and this is another big step towards that. So thank you for bringing the bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Miller, for bringing this forward and continuing to bring this forward. I couldn't support it anymore. I was just hoping you could speak a little bit more. I know you've touched on it, but a little bit more on the scope and kind of the changing face of prostitution and where it's gone. And, you know, you had mentioned being on the web and, you know, some of these back pages and things where people solicit the massage parlors that are connecting or that are kind of popping up all over. Can you just talk a little bit more about sort of this changing face of prostitution and what it really is and how many of those folks are actually victims of sex trafficking as opposed to maybe doing it because they want to do it?
Ms. Ambrose?
Sure. I will say something, and then if you do want to say anything, you can. I think the biggest change we've seen is just that we're seeing a large number of young people who are recruited in by peers or other young people because the traffickers are smart and they know peer influence is huge when you're a young person. And so they'll have, traffickers will have young people go out and recruit other young people. So it's not happening as much as, like, I know in the news that a lot of times it'll say the Mall of America is a hot spot for traffickers, but actually what we're seeing is young people are recruiting other young people. Sometimes youth are literally born into it because their families have been involved in the life for several generations, and so they're literally born into it and are being trafficked by family members or people that are caregivers. And then in terms of the online, we definitely see online use, and when one website portal is shut down, mm-hmm. another one pops up. It's just really fast. And so the trends within the life or sexual exploitation are constantly changing, so it's really important for us both as service providers and law enforcement to listen and work in partnership with young people because they are truly the expert at what's going on. But online advertising is definitely happening. Like I said, recruitment is being done a lot by peers, online, things of that nature. And the youth that are most vulnerable are young people who are experiencing homelessness, running away, who are living in foster care. And so, you know, it's really, we really appreciate the support that everyone's given to the Homeless Youth Act as well, because that is a really good thing to do, obviously, but also it helps to prevent young people from becoming trafficked if they have a safe place to live. So those are some of the trends, or I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Representative O'Neill?
Mr. Chair, and could you just speak its connection to organized crime and even how they've been trafficked across the entire United States? You had mentioned very briefly, you know, California, Texas, and, you know, there's these large organized crime rings now, and I know that some of those have been broken, and the FBI and BCA and different law enforcement agencies have been infiltrating them and kind of breaking some up, but as they break up, more kind of pop up. But can you just talk about, you know, how that you see that right here in Minnesota, all this organized crime from maybe even from other countries?
Sure. So we see organized crime in different ways. Sometimes it's, again, organized by families that are smaller, and sometimes it's organized by larger gangs or criminal, you know, basically people that are in criminal enterprises that might be also selling drugs, mm-hmm. and they're using drugs as a way to actually get, as another mechanism in addition to violence and coercion of getting young people to stay with them because they get them addicted to that and then continue to have to do sexual acts in order to get the drugs. So not all the time, but sometimes. So we definitely see gangs. We definitely see families. We definitely see from my experience with 18 years of working with young people in the life, no one's ever out there choosing to do this because they want to. Mm-hmm. They're choosing to do it because they want to. It's that or a lack of other choices to survive, right? So we really look at all people that are involved in this as being victimized in some way. Even if they don't have a third-party trafficker, someone is exploiting a situation of poverty and all of that. So we really look at it that way. And we do see it on organized crime in multiple different ways. And we do see youth being brought to different, not even sometimes different states, but also different cities within Minnesota and or different cities in different states so that they are taking them to different parties, circuits, different hotels, different things like that. And so it's unfortunately a large enterprise where a lot of money is being made. Unfortunately, the young people aren't seeing that. They're basically getting sexually assaulted for somebody else's profit. So we definitely appreciate everyone in here supporting this bill. And if you two, if you can have it.
Okay, we've got a couple questions here. Representative Ward, followed by Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank all of you for your work on this and standing up to come to us and tell us your stories. My question really is, when the beds are full, you said we'll work with you, we'll find some place. What happens? Where are you finding places? What happens to these children when there are no beds available, and that happens around the state? Where do they go?
Go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you for the question. That is a very difficult thing. And so, fortunately, I work with a great number of staff at the link, and what we basically do is we first try to find another shelter bed at one of our partner organizations, so 180 Degrees, Heartland Girls Ranch, Lifehouse in Duluth. We partner very closely with the other Safe Harbor grantees, which is great, and so we will try to figure out if there is another opening in Duluth or in St. Paul. You know, we'll help arrange transportation. It's oftentimes, frankly, our staff driving the young person there, which is fine, but we'll figure it out. So that's the best case scenario. If that's not, if there isn't any beds open anywhere, then we have done things in situations where we'll do a 2 or 3 night hotel stay, which is not ideal for a young person, but it's definitely better than them going back to the trafficker. And so if we put a youth in a hotel, then we will provide a lot of staff on-site services to help the young person until we can get them from that room to somewhere else that's obviously a more longer-term ideal situation. We also, of course, are mandated reporters, so we do report all of these situations to our county, whichever county child protection that the youth is presenting from. And so sometimes we're able to work out a placement through them, but oftentimes their shelters and foster care placements are full or might take a little bit longer to get into. So that's basically what we're trying to do. And, of course, these situations most oftentimes come up at 3 in the morning. So, yeah.
Representative Ward, follow up?
Yes, just a quick one, please. Can you describe what your shelter looks like and what kind of facilities that the kids are going into, please?
Sure. Well,
and ma'am, if we could keep our questions and answers short and concise, we got so much to go through, so go ahead.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, I think I'd like to defer to Fawn and Simi, who actually helped me open it. Would that be okay?
Our shelter, when you come in, there's a warm-up in the main space. It's painted red. We have 6 shelter beds, and each youth has their own bedroom painted a different color, and they can decorate it any way they want. In the middle, we have our great room, which is a living room slash dining room, and it's just a big giant room that the kids can do activities and eat and stuff like that, and that's the shelter.
Fawn came up with the name Passageways simply because of Harriet Tubman. She built passageways in order to help the slaves to get out to make a better way and everything. So that's what we're trying to do and everything. The names that are on some of the rooms are something like Sojourner Truth or Martin Luther King, basically someone of an inspiration to us and everything. I mean, we painted everything, the colors from, everything. There's school there, there's safety, there's protection, and there's a place to call home there, a passageways.
Yeah. Okay. Representative, I have to, in the wrong order, Representative Hillstrom is next, followed by Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the author. I'm strongly supportive of the proposal. I just want to ask some technical questions about the language of the bill. It takes money from the Safe Harbor Youth account, which is forfeiture dollars. Is this all the money that's available, or are there other funds in that account, or do you know how much money's there?
I'm going to defer to my one testifier, Jeff Bauer. He's going to be able to break down some of those different pots of money.
Go ahead, sir. Your name and title.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom. Once again, Jeff Bauer, Vice President of Public Affairs at the Family Partnership. The technical language in the bill, this is actually This fund and the transfer of these funds was established a number of years ago when we first passed the Safe Harbor Law, so this was a request from the department just to make that transfer of funds easier. The account, and Ms. Magnuson, I believe, is here and can speak to specific amounts. As far as I understand, the most that has ever been in this account was, I think, $60,000 or something like that. That's been transferred to MDH for Safe Harbor services. It doesn't generate as much as you would think it might, and which is why we're supplementing with these other requests here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second question that I have is many of the shelter beds that we do here in Minnesota go through the Office of Justice Programming, which is through the Department of Public Safety. So my question is, why is this going through Human Services? Is it strictly because there are other Human Services issues that are easier to deal with having only one agency involved? But I see there's two. So why is it structured differently than the other shelters that we fund here in Minnesota?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, because all of the homeless youth beds go through the Department of Human Services when we were first setting this up, because there's so much crossover between those two populations, it seemed to make the most sense in terms of administrative efficiency and just the systems that they already had set up in DHS around licensing and granting and things like that, that it made the most sense to put these beds there as well.
Mr. Chair.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question then. Does the Commissioner of Human Services and the Commissioner of Health have the same evaluation standards that we use for other shelter beds to ensure that the money is actually getting to the youth that need it and to ensure that the programs that are providing the services are actually providing those services to the youth?
Bauer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, great questions as always. The answer is they do use the same standards that they've used to evaluate homeless youth beds and the effectiveness of those beds. I know the department has done a really great job of providing kind of capacity building to the Safe Harbor shelter providers, because this is new over the past few years, to make sure that they're meeting all the safety and licensing and all those same requirements that the other programs that house youth have to meet. It's a shared evaluation for all of the Safe Harbor programs between health and human services.
One last question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the last question that I have is, originally you came, this is for the last set of dollars that you came for, and again, I'm strongly supportive. Do you anticipate that you'll be coming back for a reevaluation in the actual dollar amount that you requested? Because I assume that you are not able to provide all the services that are needed in this area.
Mr. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I really see this as finishing building out phase one. But what I will say, particularly relevant to this committee, is the more training that has happened with law enforcement around the state, and again, tip of the hat to Representative Pinto for that work, it's almost immediate. We'll do a training in a region of the state, and once they know what to look for and how to investigate, we're finding more of these cases. And so I think it would be naive to think that we won't continue to find more and more of these kids the more that people are trained, and that there will almost undoubtedly be a phase two to this project.
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Miller, and to your testifiers for bringing this bill forward. It's a good work that you're doing, and I support this. This committee has heard this topic, unfortunately, a number of times over the years. And as I listen to you present your bill, again, I think you're doing a good work here, but what I'm hearing is that this is primarily taking care of the issue on the domestic level. As we have heard in this committee in the past, that there is an international impact. We have this trafficking business, especially through the Port of Duluth. We have young people coming from all parts of the world. So could you just touch on this as what you're doing here? Because primarily, you know, we're working with our own kids. The domestic side, is there any outreach to these other people that are being brought here from Asia or from Central Europe, that area?
Well, the short answer, if we could.
The short answer is yes. So all of the Safe Harbor services and No Rhyme or Response also serves international victims. We have actually one right now that was a referral through Olmsted County at Passageways.
All right, thank you. Okay, thank you. Representative Considine, and then Johnson, and then we'll try to wrap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't really have a question. I just want to thank the two young ladies that testified. They tell us that public speaking is the most frightening thing there is, so I understand this is probably kind of difficult, but I want to assure you that it was very helpful for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. First of all, I want to thank the testifiers, Ms. Ambrose, Ms. Lemieux, and Ms. Williams, especially the two young ladies. It takes a lot of courage to get up and testify before any committee. Mr. Bauer, this probably is a question that you could answer. Right now we have 40 beds, and from the testimony from Ms. Ambrose that sometimes that's not enough. How many beds do you think we actually need? My personal opinion, if we need one bed, that's too many. I'd like to wipe this out completely, but how many beds short do you think we are to run the program satisfactorily for the next 2 years?
Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I hesitate to put a concrete number out there. If I was put on the spot, I would say getting up to 60 would be really important, not only as a sort of a raw total number, but also there are geographic gaps still. There are places where law enforcement or whomever, they don't have those resources anywhere near, and so I'd like to see a better geographic distribution. The other thing I'll say is it's important to note that none of these beds are fully funded. The state dollars help subsidize them, but all of these organizations, including the Link, are working really hard to fund the rest of these beds. So even the ones we currently have, it's a struggle to keep them open.
Thank you.
All right. Any public testimony? Anybody out here? Sir. Approach. Name and title, and keep it short as possible, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Keith Lacismo. I'm the Executive Director of Trafficking Justice, a nonprofit organization here in the Twin Cities, a faith-based organization comprised of individuals that strongly support the end of sex trafficking in our state. I just want to make brief comments in complete support of this bill. I want to thank Representative Miller and Representative Pinto for their advocacy here. If you think of the worst thing possible that could possibly happen to your daughter, your son, your granddaughter, your grandson, it's probably going to be something like being exploited sexually 5 to 20 times a day under emotional manipulation control. And so I thank you for your consideration of this bill. I would ask that all of us would think about whether we wanted this to happen to our children, to our grandchildren. And we're talking not just about beds, we're talking about services, trauma care, everything that can help these victims, these survivors, these courageous survivors, to understand that they are not a piece of trash, that they are valuable, that they are loved, and that we want to do everything possible to bring healing and restoration to their lives. So thank you very much. I strongly, and we represent hundreds and hundreds of church members around the state that are standing behind these survivors, these victims, and we plead with you to approve this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And closing comments, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just ask for everyone's support.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson, would you like to renew your motion?
I would like to renew that motion to re-refer to Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay. Representative Johnson renews his motion to refer to Health and Human Services. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. Thank you, Representative. And House File 713, your next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do need to get, I have an amendment which will get this bill into the shape that we need it.
Okay, I'll move House File 714 to, 713 to be referred to Health and Human Services Finance, and also move your A3 amendment if you would like to. Well, let's just move it to get it into the shape the author would like it. With no objection. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, through your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Pinto said earlier that we are a leader in the nation when it comes to trafficking of youth, and we certainly have. And it's, I think, been in large part because, as you've seen represented here, it's been very nonpartisan. We have Representative Pinto has been a leader in the law enforcement side of this, and I've worked very hard the past couple of years, and people who preceded me have worked very hard, and I think we understand the issue here, and people have come together. This bill addresses exactly that. While we're a leader in the nation, we also have a problem, and one of the challenges we have is that there are people over the age of 18 which are also being trafficked and held under someone else's control and being used for sex trafficking. The challenge that we have that this bill addresses directly is how exactly we resolve that. After much discussion with a lot of stakeholders from across the spectrum of people that are involved in this, we've come to the conclusion that what's best to do is to build a strategic plan over the next year, and in that strategic plan we will develop a bill which addresses this problem. Some of the challenges and some of the questions that we have directly relate to how law enforcement is going to deal with this, and so my two testifiers that I'm going to focus on here are directly with law enforcement. The first person I'd like to introduce, and then we'll go down the road. I believe Chief Dave Bentrud is going to be going first. He's the chief of Great Park Police. Let my testifiers do the talking.
Chief, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair Cornish and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit. I'll try to keep as brief as I can, but I wanted to give you a little sense of the scope of the issue as we see it in central Minnesota.
Your name and title.
I'm sorry?
Your name and title.
Oh, sorry. Dave Bentrud. I'm police chief in Waite Park. And if you're not familiar with the St. Cloud metro area, Waite Park is immediately adjacent to St. Cloud on the western border. And I've been in law enforcement in that area for about 25 years, 16 years with St. Cloud PD, and now 9 years as chief in Waite Park. And it was about 5 years ago that we had some contact with investigators from the state human trafficking task force, but they were looking for a juvenile female out of the Twin Cities that was being trafficked in the St. Cloud metro area. Turns out it was actually in a motel within my city. And when I first heard about that, I have to say that I kind of took that personal. Not in my town, not at this time. And as a result of that, I tasked one of my investigators with trying to discern the scope of the issue. And we started looking at various social media websites that were typically used for promoting prostitution. And when we looked on the back page and some others at that time, there were 15 to 20 ads from different women offering various forms of escort services, etc. We started doing a series of knock and talks. And from that, we recognized that we had a serious issue. I suspect during the course of my career that prostitution has been occurring. But in the last 5 or 6 years, clearly something has changed. There was a shift. And it became a much more significant issue. We started the process of identifying a number of women who were being trafficked and working as prostitutes. We had a shooting in Waite Park in December of 2014, in which we had all the elements there. We had gang members involved. We had a significant amount of drugs present. We had shots being fired. And we also had a 16-year-old juvenile female from northern Minnesota in our city being trafficked out of one of the motel rooms. And so we started to recognize again that we have a very serious issue. Waite Park is a small agency. I don't have enough resources to have a sex crimes unit of my own. So it was very important that we collaborate with our neighboring agencies. We've worked with St. Cloud Police Department, members of the Central Minnesota Violent Offender Task Force, other cities in our area and I would describe it somewhat as an informal task force. We've been working under a mutual aid agreement. And as a result of that effort, we identified well over 100 women who were being trafficked. We estimate that about 80%, upwards of 80% of those women were being trafficked by somebody. In other words, there was a pimp involved. And the rest were probably, I would say, maybe more freelancing, if you will, to support some type of a habit, either chemical dependency or maybe gambling or whatever. As a result, we arrested well over 100 individuals for soliciting of prostitution, including several felony arrests for soliciting for sex with a minor. And all of that done, again, rather informally. And I'm sure Janelle probably talked about the fact that we have made several arrests of individuals who are directly involved in trafficking women, and several of them have been sent to prison for a very long time. So suffice it to say that two things were identified really early, or more recently. One is we need to figure out a way to allocate more law enforcement investigative resources to this issue. Secondly, we need to figure out a way to provide support services, victim services, to those women who are being trafficked. Our philosophy is that women who are being trafficked are victims. And we, for adults, most of the women that we've had contact with are probably 18 to 26 years of age. We need to provide what I call a safe house for them. We just can't take the information they have and put them back on the street to reconnect with their pimp or whatever. We need to find a safe place for them to be able to try to get them out of lifestyle as best we can. And so those are two glaring needs that we have. And I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about what we're dealing with in our part of the state. And I suspect that we're not unlike other areas of the state as well. We've had women with addresses as far away as Nevada, California, and Texas, along with a lot of women who are tied to the metro area. We have arrested Johns from probably a 50, 60-mile radius of the St. Cloud Metro. And so, again, it's a huge issue for us, and I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about what we're dealing with.
Okay, thank you, Chief. And Ms. Kendall, would you introduce yourself and your title?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Janelle Kendall. I'm a Stearns County attorney in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And as Chief Ventrude had said, when we started looking in our files, and I credit Representative Pinto, his boss, John Choi, said, Kendall, you've got the second largest demand for prostitutes outside the metro area. And once we started to look, there was no question that was true. As the Chief has said, basically in our spare time, we've got over 100 Johns that we've arrested. We've prosecuted successfully 8 pimps so far. These dudes are career criminals. They're coming to me with a criminal history for the most part. They sell drugs one day, they sell women the next, because they can sell drugs once, they could sell her 10 to 15 times a day. We've identified this in every hotel and motel in the Stearns County area, certainly in St. Cloud. But where we're having some success is this partnership overall in working with the women who are being in trafficked, and how do you get them to testify? This isn't like a domestic violence case, which is our pre-existing. We have a domestic violence partnership in Stearns County. We're a federal mentor court. But when you're looking at trafficking, these women have to testify, as Representative Pinto knows. So this partnership and what we're talking about with this bill is, let's take a step back and let's look at out here in the real world what's really going on with these women. They aren't all women. We do have one 15-year-old boy out of Cold Spring who is doing business with 6 adult men in the city of Cold Spring. We found him in a suicidal unit, not surprisingly, because in a town that size, that's what you're going to see. To the question about this being international, this is in St. Cloud. One of the first girls we talked to was 6 doors down from the cop that she was talking to in Avon, Lake Wobegon, people. This is going on right here in our state, in our town. I think it's easy to kind of step back and think this is coming from somewhere else. But this is real. It's in our community. We've had some success when we can approach people appropriately and as human beings and getting them to testify against these pimps. So we are having some success. But the idea that it's just a metro thing, as Representative Howe knows, this has been on the front page of the St. Cloud Times. They actually printed the pictures of all the Johns, which frankly concerned me greatly because I was afraid about the collateral effect of that when a 14-year-old girl in Albany or Sauk Center gets up on Sunday morning and opens up the paper and there's Dad's picture. But that was how we convinced our community that this is real. and that this is going on in our towns and our communities. So when Representative Miller came to our task force, and he's been sitting there filter-free, hearing like this from prosecutors who are trying the cases, from cops who are investigating. We've got a video that I hope a number of you have seen. We have so many requests, Mr. Chair, to come out and talk about this in this community that we can't keep up. So we use criminal forfeiture dollars, and we made a video to help do some training on it. But this step back and look and see what should we be doing with these adult persons, I'm not in favor of decriminalization. I'm not. It gives us an opportunity to step in, to intervene, to deal with some things that are going on here. But the idea that we would step back and create a task force and be able to have those candid conversations, I think as a prosecutor is a good idea, because we need to get that sort of reality check on what's really going on, be able to have that conversation, and come back with some recommendations that everyone can live with.
Okay. Any questions, members? Representative
Pinto. Let's be real brief, Mr. Chair. I just want to say this is the piece I'm really particularly excited about. I want to thank County Attorney Kendall for her leadership and work, and the Chief Wade Park has done just amazing work, has been leading things along the way. This is about the best $75,000 expenditure that I can think of. This will continue our leadership. And just for folks to be aware, most of the adult women prostituting started off as kids, and I will say that this helps with our fight against victimization of kids, because there is a little bit of a sense, law enforcement mothers kind of saying, well, wait a second, if she's 17 and 11 months, we treat her as a victim. If she's 18 and 1 month, and she's a victim of sex trafficking, and yet it's just really complicated. So understanding that and extending those services support seems critical. So thank you very much for your work.
Thank you, Representative Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too, am very excited about your bill, but this question is for you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, quite often in this committee, we have a very bipartisan bill, and we tend to fund these public safety kinds of issues pretty overwhelmingly bipartisan. The Health Committee always gets a negative target. The Health Committee always gets a negative target. And so, Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that you'll consider watching what happens with the Health Committee target, and if they don't have the money to fund these kinds of programs, I hope you'll consider whether or not there's room in our budget for these kinds of programs, Mr. Chair. I think they're very important. I think it's very bipartisan, and I think that when targets come out, we should make sure that these programs are funded.
All right. Other questions? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank you and thank Representative Pinto and Representative Miller, but also just remind everyone that ultimately these problems will continue to exist as long as there are men who seek these victims. And so, you know, people being brought in from other places, they wouldn't be brought here if there wasn't a demand for those things. And so I appreciate all the support of victims, but ultimately if we're going to address this, we have to also focus on the perpetrators. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, we have sponsored probably four John schools now in Wake Park, where men that have been arrested have shown up, and so we are trying to address that issue as well.
Okay, thank you. Any public testimony? Oh, Representative Howell, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm quite familiar with our issue there, and I know that we're also working on another bill to give small cities the tools to deal with some of these hotels that we struggle with getting access to. So that's another piece of the puzzle here that we're working on closing, but thanks for your efforts.
Okay, thank you. Members, public testimony? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion for House File 713 as amended to be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much, Reverend Miller. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Now, House File 329, Representative Rarick. The chair will move House File 329 to be re-referred to the government operations, and also move the A2 amendment to get into the shape the author would like. Objections, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The House File 329 amended is before us, Representative Rarick. And I believe this is probably for the information for the room here, this is probably at least the third time we've heard the fireworks bill. So I'm hoping that all the members will just kind of keep general broad statements we've all heard and said before to a minimum, and we'll just take action on this bill, whatever it may be. Representative Rarick.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could make a comment about that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, there's a number of new members on our committee, so I'm hoping that we won't limit some of that conversation because, again, on our side we have some new members, and on your side you have some new members, and they have not heard any of those arguments yet.
I don't really know how I would limit any conversation. I never have yet. So, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have actually tried to reach out to most of the new members to kind of let them know I'm going to focus most of my testimony on some of the changes, but I'm more than willing to answer any questions that come up. So with that, House File 329 is looking to expand the sales and use of fireworks in Minnesota. In 2002, we legalized the use of what is called novelties, ground-based and spark-emitting. This is looking to expand to what technically would be a 1.4G. We're defining that as aerial and audible. Firecrackers, bottle rockets, Roman candles, and then types that would be put into a launch tube. So these would go into the air and make noise, basically. As the chairman said, this is the third or fourth time that I've presented this. We've been getting a lot of feedback from different groups. And so some of the things that we've tried to address, I'll go over that, the amendment and some of the other things when we originally drafted it, are looking to address that. One of the main changes that has been made is the issue over the safety of where fireworks are sold. And I'm sure many of you have heard that you would like to have fireworks sold in a permanent structure that meets fire code. And I listened to those testimonies arguments very closely. But one of the big issues we have is in the state of Minnesota, we have several nonprofit organizations, say Boy Scouts, church groups. They use this as one of their main fundraisers for the year. And they use tents to do this for a short period of time. If you remember, we limited the sale of aerial and audible fireworks last year to about a 5 or 6 week period so we could stay with tents. What we have done to try to work with both groups is we are expanding to allow sales year-round. If you're going to sell for 60 days or less, you would be allowed to sell in a tent. That is going to allow our nonprofit organizations and small organizations to be able to sell. If you're going to sell for more than 60 days, you would then be required to go into a permanent structure that meets fire code. One of the other reasons for this as well, permanent structures would be built in areas of high residency, areas in rural Minnesota with smaller populations would not see these structures put up. And realistically, it's the areas in rural Minnesota that are really looking for this and where they're more appropriate to be used. And as many of you know before, you know, we have this in the bill specifically that local jurisdictions can ban the sales and use. So places of higher population can ban them. But so we don't want to, I don't want to be able to restrict groups from being able to sell. And I believe by restricting the use of tents that's what we're doing. The number one reason that I'm bringing this, many of you know, if you drive around on Independence Day and the weekends around it, the fireworks are here. The state of Wisconsin, the states of North and South Dakota are selling these fireworks, and they're selling them to Minnesotans. I stopped at one of these places last year on July 2nd and asked them approximately how many people that you're selling to are from Minnesota. Their response was about 80%. So the fireworks are here. So one thing I would like you to keep in mind as we, you know, one of the issues that we have, we know fireworks in and of themselves can be dangerous if used improperly. So there is the risk of injury, there is the risk of fire. But because they're already here and Minnesotans who want to use them have access to them, I do not believe that we are going to see a large increase in injuries or in fires. They're already here and they're being used. So in 2010, it was estimated that Minnesota is losing about $5 million a year in sales taxes alone. And I believe if Minnesotans are going to be using the fireworks, Minnesota should be collecting that revenue. One of the other issues in regard to safety is if we pass the law allowing them here, you will see the fireworks companies running ads, and included in those ads are safety precautions and safe ways to use the fireworks. That's what's happened in other states, and that just continues to make them safer. And if you look at the chart that I passed out, you'll see that since 1976 till today, there's been a dramatic increase in the use of fireworks, yet the injuries have gone down. And that's because the industry is making safer fireworks and they're promoting the safe use of fireworks. So with that, I will end my testimony and move to the testifiers or questions.
Why don't we go down the list here, and then we'll ask for public testimony when we get done, too, if there's anybody missing. But Mr. Haynes, a co-owner of Bear Creek Pyrotechnics, are you here? Would you like to come up and give us your name and title and begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Haynes. I'm a co-owner of Bear Creek Pyrotechnics. We operate out of Hinckley, Minnesota. We're a small business. We do fireworks displays. We would like to grow our business, and the way we would do that would be to be selling these aerial fireworks that's on HF 329. It's a difficult environment for small businesses to grow in these days, and this is an opportunity to become profitable, to grow, to hire people. The way it is right now, people are going across the borders. I work off of a trunk highway, Highway 48. I live 2 miles south of that. We operate our business out of there. I'm watching my friends and neighbors drive across the river, and I'm watching not only tax dollars go out the door, but I'm watching the profitability of my business go down the drain with it. The opportunity to expand our business and hire people is something we've long sought, and we would like the opportunity to see HF 329 get approved. Again, thank you for allowing me to testify here today.
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions for our testifier? If none, thank you, sir. Mr. Bruce West, the Minnesota State Fire Marshal. Our firefighter friends, this is about the only issue we're crossways on, I think.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. And for the record, I am Bruce West. I'm your Minnesota State Fire Marshal. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity for my testimony today. It is the State Fire Marshal Division's mission to protect the safety and well-being of the citizens of Minnesota. Included in this is our dedication to protect all Minnesotans, including the innocent bystanders of all ages who may become victims of someone else's carelessness when igniting fireworks. As Representative Rarick said, prior to 2002, essentially all fireworks were illegal in Minnesota. In reviewing the statistics, and all of you should have received a handout that was developed by the State Fire Marshal Division on injuries and also property damage, property loss. Fireworks-related injuries from 1992 to 2001 and the period 2002 to 2016, in which non-aerial and non-explosive fireworks, you can see that the injuries rose by 120% from 2002 to 2016. Even more concerning to me as your state fire marshal is that nearly 50% of the injuries from 2002 to 2016 were suffered by citizens 19 years of age and younger, and 22% were children 9 years old and younger. Since 2002, statistics also show a significant increase in property damage loss in the state of Minnesota. Even more, the changes in the current fireworks statute could exaggerate these statistics. It's going to increase these statistics. For these reasons, I'm opposed to the bill. Fireworks are dangerous, even in a well-supervised fireworks use, and fireworks is exceedingly dangerous. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify before your committee today, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Any questions for our testifier? If none, Chief Wayne, pronounce your name when you come up. Oh, both the chiefs come up, you bet. Chief Jungman and Keith Kiewicz?
Kiewicz. Chair Cornish and committee members, I want to begin by thanking you for your support of the fire service and many initiatives that have come before you. Thank you for taking my testimony today as you deliberate on whether or not to expand the fireworks in Minnesota. I am BJ Jungman. I'm the fire chief for the city of Burnsville, and beside me is Fire Chief Wayne Kiewicz from the city of Richfield. We are here on behalf of four Minnesota Fire Service organizations, the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, the Minnesota Fire Department Association, the Fire Marshals Association of Minnesota, and the International Association of Arson Investigators, the Minnesota chapter. As passionate advocates of public safety, we oppose the legalization of the recreational use of explosives. We call them fireworks, but what we're really talking about is legalizing broad use of ground and aerial explosive by the general public. There's no question that they cause injury and fire, and should this legislation pass, we can expect an increase in both. Part of the bill uses the American Pyrotechnics Association standards. It allows voting membership, only voting membership to commercial users, importers of fireworks, distribution of fireworks, and manufacturing of fireworks, thus leaving important stakeholders of the fire service out of that. It also references the National Fire Protection Association 1124 standard version from 2006, which is not the current standard. The legislation does not allow for important safety measures that are currently used with aerial explosives in Minnesota, such as fallout zones, permission for use, restrictions on weather, insurance and bonding restrictions, kill switches, training and certification for the operator, and the checking for hot embers after discharging the explosives. We believe that these explosives are best handled and discharged by qualified individuals to ensure the safety of everyone, which is currently in place in Minnesota. The Minnesota-specific data is relayed by the state fire marshal that we've seen an increase in injuries and property damage. We want to acknowledge Representative Rarick as he has directed a portion of the sales tax receipts from the fireworks sale towards firefighting equipment in small departments and the fire safety account. While this is greatly appreciated, we can't in good conscience support this bill to legalize the recreational use of explosives. Make no mistakes, fireworks injure people and cause property damage, so why take a chance? We ask you to join a long list of organizations that oppose the expansion of fireworks due to the increased risk to public safety. There was a handout given that has a list of the opponents of the fireworks bill, and those include the Minnesota Chapter of American College of Emergency Physicians, the League of Minnesota Cities, and other associations. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and Chief Kiewicz and I will stand for any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Any questions, members, so far? Okay, if there is none, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And Dan Peart of Phantom Fireworks, would you come up? Yes. Go ahead, sir, with your introduction and then your testimony.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dan Peart, and I'm the Director of Government Relations with Phantom Fireworks, the nation's leading retailer of consumer fireworks. At the onset, let me say that Phantom supports the expansion of consumer fireworks sales and use in the state of Minnesota. Our only reservation is that in doing so, we employ all of the current safety measures that have been adopted and formally proven to be successful in other states as well. Specifically, we focus on the sales venues, and as it's not prescribed specifically in House Filing 329, what that essentially means is this becomes a tent state as it refers to consumer fireworks. And while we understand some of the impetus for this decision, I'm not sure that any of the logic or reasoning for the other side, you know, has been adequately considered. But long and short of it is, in a
permanent consumer fireworks retail sales facility, you're able to take advantage of all the current safety standards available to the fireworks industry today. It's 2017. The fireworks industry has been around for a long time. Our company has been around for over 40 years. Like any industry, we have evolved over time, and we have learned that there are better ways to do things than the way that we did things 40 and 50 years ago. And as I look at House Filing 329, this looks like a fireworks bill that would be reminiscent of a state that legalized fireworks 30 or 40 years ago. Change a few words, put the tax money somewhere, and fireworks are now legal. We do bring in NFPA 1124, which I think is a great example, and I think any state that's legalized fireworks in the last 5 years has done so. However, making it an unfettered, you know, really unregulated tent state, you know, does a couple of things. Again, you are not taking advantage of any of the current safety standards as far as, one, hard walls and a ceiling, you know, that provide immediate containment from any of the worst-case scenarios that may present themselves in a building full of explosives. And on top of that, you do not have a sprinkler system. You don't have a properly designed shelving system set up to adequately contain anything into that specific area inside of one of the stores. The tent industry is a two-week industry. So anybody that's in that business and operating out of a tent is in the fireworks business. They're a fireworks employee for 2 weeks out of the year. There is no possible way that these people are adequately trained to answer the questions that you're faced with in a consumer fireworks retail sales facility around the 4th of July. I've been in this business for 15 years, and I promise you, you're not equipped to answer the questions that are posed to you with 2 weeks of training that is largely focused on cash handling, for that matter. Nonetheless, not even having seen all of the fireworks that you're going to be selling and asking these or having the questions asked to you about. Tent sales, on top of that, offer no economic impact to the state whatsoever. With this bill, you will have no one buying property and building a store. You will have no one occupying a vacant building that sits anywhere in the state. You will not create jobs with this bill. The people that are working in tents are independent contractors. We're using the group, the term community groups and nonprofit organizations, and it's nice. You know, based on what you are selling right now in the state, the ground-based consumer fireworks, it's arguable, but maybe that's okay. You know, these are items where you light a fuse, and they pretty much stay where they are. We're talking about legalizing to the full line of consumer fireworks. Some of these items are going to travel 150, 200 feet in the air or whichever direction they're pointed. I'm not sure at that point that the Boy Scouts or the Little League team is the most sensible alternative to be selling those types of fireworks or to be the education expert for these types of fireworks that are currently illegal in the state. We do have a bill that we've worked with Representative Lunan on. It's House Filing 1191, and it mirrors very closely the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania allows the full line of consumer fireworks, so what we're talking about enabling in this legislation, to be sold out of a permanent brick-and-mortar facility. Ground-based fireworks can be sold out of tents. Currently, the numbers in Pennsylvania are there are 84 brick-and-mortar facilities in the state of Pennsylvania. This model has been accused of, you know, being anti-competitive and you know, monopolistic and other ideas like that by us. Our company, Phantom Fireworks, is the largest fireworks retailer in the state of Pennsylvania. We have 7 locations. There are 84. We have less than 10% of the licenses in the state. The majority of the locations after that are in the rural areas that we're talking about populating with fireworks in Minnesota. Pennsylvania demographically sets up very similar to Minnesota in that there are 2 large pockets of population. Everything else is very rural. The majority of these locations in PA are very rural. On top of that, they have in between 500 and 600 tent locations that are selling the ground level of consumer fireworks. So the community groups are doing quite well in Pennsylvania. So I'd point that out to some of the arguments on the other side that claim that this is not a fair rendition of a fireworks bill. On top of that, I think that in the current bill, there's no age restriction for the sale of fireworks. We talk about you have to be 18 to purchase fireworks. There's no restriction on age for somebody working in a consumer fireworks retail sales facility. It seems to me that if you have to be 18 to buy, you should have to be 18 to sell. And I think at very best, there is some confusing language as to the prospect of local control. In the summary for House Filing 329, it says that communities can't opt in or opt out of sale and use. And just quickly, if you look at the very last page of the bill, lines 1 through 4, it says you cannot regulate or restrict the sale or use. But then, a couple sections down, it says that you can. So I assume your intent is that there is, but the language is, in my opinion, somewhat confusing.
So with that said, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate your time. Thank you for listening, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Sir, what would you say to your critics that say that safety isn't your primary motive, but you're more worried about competition moving in on you?
Well, I would say to that that we have one of the best stores in our company that's in the state of Wisconsin, which is doing a lot of business out of the residents or off the backs of the residents in this state. And we have initiated pro-fireworks legislation in Minnesota for 2 to 3 years now. We have not had the opportunity to gain much traction to it, but if the argument was purely to keep people off of our back, we wouldn't be looking to open up the state. Apart from that, the example of Pennsylvania that I mentioned. I don't know how I can any more clearly illustrate that advancing responsible legislation in the name of safety is anti-competitive in any way.
Yeah, sir, I think the point I was getting at about the tents and things like this, personally, if we're going to sell it, I'd just soon open her up, but that's just my personal opinion. But thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Anything else?
No, sir.
Okay. Representative Rake, do you have any comments to make or rebuttal after some of the testimony, sir?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick follow-ups. One, I appreciate, and I will look into it. This is the first anybody has mentioned to me about putting in an age limit for selling fireworks. So I'm absolutely open to, and I will look at getting some language drafted, doing the same thing, having an age limit for selling as well. A couple of the points that were brought up. One that was brought up about that the industry sets the definition of the fireworks. We made it very specific in the bill that we tied the definition to a date so that if the industry changes the definition of the fireworks, that will not change Minnesota's law. We are tied to a definition, and it will require the legislature to take action to change what is legal and what is not legal. Another thought that I had, I know that this is a very temporary. Independence Day is the main time fireworks would be used. This is a very temporary, and I get that, and I understand the issue of the safety. Many of these tent operations, they are buying the fireworks from a distributor. The distributor brings in a metal storage container where the vast majority of their stock is contained. So they're only bringing out small amounts into the tent at one time. So there is that containment. It is typically one of these metal storage containers that you would, similar to what you would see being on a train, these ones that you rent and set in a location for temporary storage. So I believe that's, doing a lot of the protecting. If there is an accident, it is contained in there, and what's in the tent is very limited. And I would liken this to the state fair. We have many people that come in with a temporary operation. They're bringing in units that have deep fryers and this and that, and they're bringing in kids. And we're not restricting the state fair and saying that this is too dangerous to do. So, and in regards to, I did save this for the end. It was brought up, and with the sales tax provision, and I didn't want to bring that up at first. I spoke to the state fire marshal and other fire chiefs. This was not an attempt to try to buy them off. But speaking to some of my small cities that have the volunteer fire departments, they have a very, very real issue of supplying their fire departments with the equipment that they need. Each individual firefighter, it costs the city a lot of money to equip that person, upkeep on their trucks and equipment. So I saw this as an opportunity, and I know it's been done in a couple of other states where you dedicate money from firework sales to the fire departments. And so 25% of the sales tax generated would go to a volunteer fire assistance grants. So all volunteer fire departments would have access to apply for a grant for buying equipment. And then another 25% would go to the fire safety account. That's accessible to the fire departments for, training, equipment. And like I said, I'm not trying to buy them off, but this would be relief for our cities, having another way to fund fire departments. We will be in government operations if we get there. We're going to be pulling that piece out and running it through as its own separate bill. But this, when we look at the $5 million that was projected last time around, We're looking at anywhere from $1.25 million to potentially $2 million because we're going to be including the novelties now as well, funding into each of those accounts per year, which will really, really help our fire department. I guess with that, I'd stand for any questions.
Hey, Representative Ray, before I have Representative Hilstrom ask a question, how many more committees does the Fun and Freedom Act have to go through before it passes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. By pulling out the sales tax provision, I believe government ops will be the final committee stop, but then the sales tax provision will have to go to property tax, taxes, and probably ways and means, and potentially environment and natural resources.
Okay, thank you, sir. Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rarick, I have a couple of questions related to the criminal law provisions that are currently in law that are not currently in your bill. Under Minnesota Statute 609.66, it is currently a felony to sell explosives to a minor. Is it your intention to keep it so that in the event a fireworks company sells to someone under the age of 18 without a parent's note, that that would be a felony? Is it your intention for that to stay a felony?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, no, that would not be my intent. So I would be more than happy to talk with you about that, how we could address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also, under criminal law, it is illegal for a felon to be in possession of fireworks as well. Is it your intention to permit or not to permit felons to possess these fireworks, as under current law, they are not eligible to possess firearm silencers or explosive devices?
Representative Rear.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I had not thought about that previously. I guess my initial reaction would be that I wouldn't think that a felon should be restricted from this use. It's recreational, unlike firearm. Some uses of firearms are recreational, but I mean, I get the point. There's a difference, and so that would be a change I'd be willing to look at as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Previously, the governor has vetoed many of the provisions that are in this proposal. I have a copy of his April 28th of 2012 veto letter. Have you taken steps in an attempt to alleviate the governor's concerns with this proposal?
Representative Rory.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have been working on that, and I have a request in with the governor's office to have a meeting with him or staff to explain the changes that we've made and see if he has any further changes that he would like to see. And I'm hoping to hear back soon that I would maybe be able to speak with him about that. So this kind of came up a little bit quicker than I anticipated, thus I don't have that meeting set up yet. But absolutely, I'm trying to speak with his office so that we can address all of his concerns.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eric, I do appreciate that you came over to me on the floor and you asked to talk to me about these proposals. And at the time, I had not yet read the language, and so I know that I asked you some of those questions, not giving you a heads up that I was going to ask them. Members, I have one of the challenges because I personally love fireworks. However, I don't like tent sales. I don't like people selling to children without their parents' consent. I don't like felons being in possession of explosive devices instead of guns or other kinds of devices. And so, members, there's a long list of folks who are opposed to the proposal at this time, and I can't support your bill. I am for fun and freedom, Mr. Chair. I have voted for fireworks previously. I just can't vote for this bill.
All right, members. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Verrett. You were talking a lot. I mean, I've seen some of these tents, and you say it's a small amount. It looks pretty big to me that they have on display and for sale. So you threw that around quite a bit. Do you have a personal definition of what a small amount would be for fireworks that are sold within a tent?
I know I've got mine, a trunk load, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I guess off the top of my head, I don't. That would be something we could potentially look at to put into language. And I have spoke with others about potentially putting in the requirement in the bill that the metal storage container would be required for the tents. And then we could look at potentially setting, using the amount of gunpowder, you know, every type has a rating or whatever, and then putting, you know, figuring out, sitting down with the industries to figure out some type, how we would do that to say you're only allowed to have so much in the tent at one time.
Mr. Chair, a couple other questions. So you put in the 60-day rule, and I'm sort of curious where that comes from, because most tents aren't up at more than 2 weeks. So how did you arrive at a 60-day rule? And maybe you mentioned it and I just missed it.
Representative Rick.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I came up with that last time around. We had about, you know, a 5 to 6 week window that we were going to allow the sale of aerial and audible. And I know that, like I said, the vast majority of the tents only come up for 2 to 3 weeks. My intent with the 60 days was that allowing a little bit more of a period for those just in case they wanted to. But for somebody who wants to go with year-round, we kind of figured that over that 60-day was going to, if you're going to sell for more than 60 days, that was a permanent. But then that's definitely something I'm willing to talk to people about and see if that should be changed.
Okay, a couple more questions, Mr. Chair. So this is maybe just because I don't know, but if I'm being a retailer of fireworks, do I have to undergo a background check?
Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, I don't think so, but that would be, I would have to look into that a little closer, because we currently have people selling and that's not covered in any of my new language. That may be covered, but I don't believe it is covered in current law. So we currently have sales.
Mr.
Representative
Chair and Representative Rock, I mean, that would really concern me, that something that a domestic terrorist could get access to become a retailer and buy large amounts of explosives and assemble them in a way that could cause huge damage in certain situations and settings throughout the country. So I'm very concerned about that. And my last question is sparklers. I don't know about you, but every box of sparklers that I've seen has a warning that says place in the ground, light, and get away. And I think almost everybody I've seen that's used sparklers hold them in their hand and swirl them around. So when you talk about some of these warnings, to be quite honest, the tobacco industry got a lot of trouble for lying to consumers, and also for, you know, they put warnings in the dangers, but they knew how dangerous it was. Sparklers are really dangerous. I mean, if you've ever been poked with one while it's lit, I mean, it can do some pretty significant harm. And I'm just curious, when you talk about these warnings, you know, do they really have any meaning at all when it comes to issues of fireworks? And that actually is a question I'd like you to answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rick, and we've got Representative Frankie and Considine left, and Representative Hilstrom's bill to do, if we can. Because we have to be out by noon. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. A lot of the speaking about is there'd actually be extra training. If you go to some of these places, you'll see they'll have videos that are playing on a continuous loop that explaining how to use fireworks safely. Some places they'll have instructions typed up, and the people selling can go over that and then send that with you. So they're not just relying on the labels. You know, unfortunately, like you said, people will misuse them. When we look at the statistics, that's unfortunately sparklers are what predominantly are kids under 9 years old that statistic was brought up. That's the injuries that are coming from there. You know, burns and the young kids are being hurt by what's already legal in Minnesota. So this bill wouldn't have an effect on the sparklers. They're already here legal. But you're right. We need people to follow directions, and I think, you know, part of this is the fireworks companies will do a better – when they are allowed to sell the bigger types, we've seen in other states, they do a much better job of running ads and things that speak towards safety and the proper use.
No response to that.
Representative Frankie and then Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Merrick, I just want to say thank you for bringing this to me ahead of time, kind of to what Representative Hillstrom was saying about the new members, and a lot. So it gave me time to go back to my fire chiefs and police chiefs, and I just wanted to add that, you know, in my district, we are just minutes away from Wisconsin, so on Independence Day, the aerials that are going on around the local park are almost better than the aerials that are sponsored by the local Lions Club. And the police don't have the opportunity to police those. It happens. It is so large. So I see the need and necessity in your bill, and I also like the fact of the tent sales. We have a couple of churches that hold the tent sales for the ground fireworks right now, currently, and it's a nice fundraiser for them. So I just wanted to once again say thank you, but at this point, with the opportunity to talk to my chiefs and some of the things that I'm hearing as far as the way the legislation is, I think eventually we could possibly get this through, but it just seems to me like it needs more work. And it's a tough road, so good luck. That's it. Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Just for you, Mr. Chair, I'm willing to forego it.
All right. Any other testimony? All right. We've got another bill up. Can you make it in 1 minute?
I can get that. Sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Russ Cunningham, Pastor Russ Cunningham. I was actually invited to come and speak for the tent because I'm a TNT tent operator. And I just want to say how important it is for us to have the tents because as a small church in a rural community, every year I run a tent. I've been doing it for 5 years now, and it's a huge fundraiser for me. We have a small church, but every Wednesday night I have about 50, 60 dysfunctional kids that show up and want their lives changed, and they're just messed up, and they can't afford to do anything. So when we do a TNT tent, we take the money that we raise, and we take each one of these kids on a two-day retreat, and for 2 days we speak life into them and joy and peace, and their lives are changed because they have the opportunity to go, and that's what we do with the money that we raise from the TNT. And we're very, you know, they train us how to be the salesman. Actually, our tents, you can't sell fireworks unless you're 18. And I just want to encourage that if you guys pass this bill, that you would allow the tents to continue to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I'm going to renew my motion on House File 329. We didn't amend it. As amended, to move to re-refer it to government operations. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom has House File 916.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that you're going to lay this bill over. Is that correct, Mr. Chair? So the motion should be for possible possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
That's correct, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, you have House File 916, which is a proposal that came out of the opioid study that was done by the Minnesota Attorney General's office. They've been hearing opioid bills all day. Today is the Opioid Awareness Day on the Hill. Members, we've sent a link to your email so that you can have a full copy of the entire study. Members, as you know, the opioid crisis is hitting Minnesota just as hard as it's hitting everyone else nationally. And we now have more overdoses based on prescription opioids than we have heroin overdoses. This just says that our sheriffs have to have boxes to dispose collection receptacles. Most counties already have it. We want more. And I've spoken with the Sheriff's Association. They would like some assistance financially if we're going to do this. So, Mr. Chair, I hope you'll consider laying this over for possible consideration, and if we have any money, that maybe we could help with this providing of these boxes. I have nothing else.
Questions? Representative Lohmer and Neuberger, and then we'll ask for public testimony after that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Hillstrom. I think it's a great idea. I just wonder if you have any idea what the cost is for that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so the 33-gallon box is about $1,000 and about $1,400 for a 68-gallon box. It's my understanding that the Sheriff's Association has worked with someone and gotten a contract that they could get them for 30% off. So right now, there are three counties that don't have them. Others have partnerships, but we know that the more there are, the more likely it is that folks will drop them in the box.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Yeah, is that a one-time cost? Do you refill them and empty them out, or is it continual cost?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's actually the price of the box. Then people will drop their drugs into the box, but it does cost the local community is the staff time to empty the boxes to make certain that then they're available for people to put more drugs in.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really quickly, Representative Hillstrom, just piggybacks on to Representative Loomer's question. There is a cost incurred because this is a special substance. You don't just throw it in the landfill. So what is the cost after they fill these buckets full of these unused drugs? What is the disposal cost to have special services have it taken away?
Representative Hillsburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have the answer to that question, so I will have to get you the answer to that question. I would bet that it probably depends on how much there is and what types of drugs there are. I bet that's more specific. We've just been working hard to have folks have places that they can leave them. We don't want them flushing them down the toilets. We don't want them leaving them in their medicine chest so that other people can get it or reuse it.
Representative Gruber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you, Representative Hillstrom. These drugs are either like oil or antifreeze or any other substance. There's going to be a special disposal cost, so I think that having that information would be really helpful.
Okay.
Okay. Any Representative Howland here? No, okay, Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very quickly, I'm hoping that at some point we could also address the source. And we have a record of physicians over-prescribing these medications. And so I do a lot of asking about this, and I have yet to find doctors who are doing this. So can we do something about finding out who is actually prescribing hundreds of pills to people when they maybe need five or six?
Representative Hillsman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is one part of a lengthy, a large number of bills, and most of those bills went to the Health Committee. And so those were heard this morning, and hopefully they'll hear them all. But there are some proposals to take care of that as well.
Public testimony. Okay, seeing none, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that meeting adjourned.